teaching Witchwood, and especially because it's the first book that Pastor Clark ever recommended to me. And I wanted to start the class by talking about Pastor Clark's recommendations, because one of the things I really appreciated about Pastor Clark was his love of literature and the fact that he recommended a number of good books to me. And I don't mean just good books the way a lot of people could recommend a good book. He recommended a lot of really best-in-class kind of recommendations. So, and Witchwood was the first book that he recommended. I don't, maybe I just said that, but. But another book that he recommended that I really benefited from was Orthodoxy by G.K. Chesterton. And before I read that, Chesterton was, to me, just a guy that everybody quoted a lot. And I read Orthodoxy, and it's a wonderful, wonderful defense of the faith. Chesterton's a happy warrior. He's got this hopefulness and optimism, and he's very humorous as well. He's got an amazing penchant for paradox. I thought of the last week's class, Eric's class on wine. One of Chesterton's quotes is, "No animal has ever invented anything as bad as drunkenness or as good as drink." That's kind of a great classic Chestertonian piece of paradox. Another one, this isn't maybe paradoxical, but it's a great Chesterton quote. It's, "The Christian ideal has not been tried and found wanting. It's been found difficult and left untried." So he has a lot of sayings like that. That's why he's so quotable. But that was a great book. It really, one of the things that, and Chesterton wrote that when he was an Anglican. It was before he converted to Catholicism. But it's something that has left in my heart a kind of a warm feeling towards the Catholic Church, that whole experience of encountering Chesterton. In fact, there's a great TV show. If you guys ever see, there he is. There's the man. Thank you, Joe. I appreciate that. I guess I should go. Maybe.
What was the TV show?
It's on the Catholic Channel. It's something put on by, I guess it's the American Chesterton Society, and there's the president is a man named Dale Asquith. But if you watch it, they'll have different actors play Chesterton, and mostly it's just delivering monologues. You see Asquith sitting in his chair talking to you about Chesterton, giving you context. But it's a it's just a very amusing and really a very profound show. It's like Chesterton himself. Always amusing, usually profound. Another book that I received from Pastor Clark was this, The Puritan Hope. And has anybody read this? It's a book about postmillennialism. I remember Pastor Clark saying once that I think we were talking about Jonathan Edwards, but he said something about how when this church first started teaching postmillennialism, he wanted people to know that postmillennialism wasn't this strange new thing that it was, you know, just a small group of Christians who adhered to, but that postmillennialism has a glorious heritage. And Jonathan Edwards being famous postmillennialist, but this book talks about the that history, that heritage. It shows you how, going back through history, postmillennialism has had a number of proponents in the church. One of the things I liked about it was its very generous treatment of the Jews. It talks a lot about how a lot of Puritans looked forward to the calling of the Jews. And that was something that, I guess was new to me. So it's something else that I appreciated. A third book. This isn't one that Pastor Clark recommended to me, but it's something that Pastor Clark had signed to my son, William, when William was a student here. The Vicar of Wakefield. This is an 18th century novel by Oliver Goldsmith. And when I found out that William was reading that, I was just delighted. Because, you know, I think in high schools nowadays, students get a lot of 20th century literature. And that's not always bad. You know, there's some important 20th century literature, some of it even good. But it's you know, I look at this as kind of an old treasure found in the attic. This delightful little tale written in the 18th century. And I think it's so important for students to get language that really challenges them. And you especially get that when you go to other times and other lands. That's what really allows young people to grow in their understanding of language. That's why it's so important not to just limit yourself to 20th century language when you're learning English. As I think about it, I wouldn't be surprised if there are a lot of high school English teachers in America who don't even know what this is. And I'm sure there aren't many that are teaching it. So I thought, how cool is that students at Tri-City Christian Academy are reading The Vicar of Wakefield? Well, Witchwood, again, was recommended to me by Pastor Clark. And one of the things I hope you'll think about as we read through it is how when I first got Witchwood, I was very new to Tri-City Covenant Church. And I found it, as I was reading it, I found it very ironic that Pastor Clark would recommend this book to me. So as you read it, one of the things I hope you'll think about is how would a newcomer to Tri-City Covenant Church find this book ironic? Something to ponder as you go through it. It is a book that one of the main themes is church and state. To what extent should the church be involved in politics and in government? So today I'd like to set the stage and provide some historical context for the book. And to do that, I think what we need to look at is first the Reformation. So when we think about the Reformation, there's really, you could say, three Reformations. There's a Lutheran Reformation, there's a Calvinist Reformation, and there's an English Reformation. Those are the three main Reformations that occurred. But starting, of course, the Reformation started with Luther in Germany, and that was the earliest one. The Calvinist Reformation came a little bit later. And how would you contrast the Lutheran Reformation and the Calvinist Reformation? What distinguished them? Any thoughts?
Lutheran Reformation was a division in the church, where the Calvinist Reformation was a division with the state.
Yeah, excellent. I think that's a great point. Mr. Edgar?
Just expanding upon Bob's comment is that John Calvin, I think, sought to apply the scriptures to every area of life, and the rub at that point was civil order. Luther tended to minimize applications with civil order because indeed the princes and kings of Germany were his protectors. So the last thing he was interested in was confronting them with their reforming their civil order. He enjoyed the protection while he sorted out the soteriological things.
Right, right. Great. So Luther was much more moderate than Calvin. The Lutheran Reformation was more limited. And you guys are spot on. Luther never thought of himself as having left the church. And as Mr. Edgar said, one of the biggest aspects of Lutheran reform was soteriology, the doctrine of justification by faith. That's what Luther emphasized. The authority of Scripture, the sole authority of Scripture within the church, another main point. So, Lutheranism laid the foundations for the Reformation, especially in some of those key doctrines, but didn't have a lot of applications outside the church, like Mr. West was saying. And within the worship service, Lutherans clung to a lot of the traditions of the Catholic Church. They continued to wear surplices. They had a lot of symbolism within their worship. Lutherans like Johann Sebastian Bach wrote masses, so there was a great love of music that was maybe similar to what the Catholic Church was doing. And then, when a few decades later, when you began to have Geneva become a center of reform activity with John Calvin and others, there was a much deeper application, maybe, of Reformation principles. Reformers there began to say, we need to take God's word and have it govern all aspects of life. We need to apply it to things outside of the church. And within the church, we need to make sure that we're rigorously adhering to God's word. So we're not going to do things in worship unless the Bible has sanctioned it. And so they began to sing the Psalter. And in many ways, they began to try to rid the church of what they consider to be the traditions of Catholicism. And so they get rid of some of the beauty, the symbolism. They purify, they simplify worship. Which of those models do you think we adhere to here at Tri-City? What would you say? I think we're kind of a beautiful blend, right? We really have a lot of both of those things. Well, with the English Reformation, you have tension between those two strands. So the English Reformation begins with Henry VIII, right? He wants to get a divorce, so he makes himself the head of the Church of England so he can get a divorce. That happens just a couple of decades after the Lutheran Reformation begins. But for the Church of England, there would be, for the next couple hundred years, tension between those who wanted a more moderate church and those who wanted a more thoroughly, Protestantly reformed church. And so you have Puritanism working first within the church and eventually beginning to move outside the church because some Puritan reformers feel that the church is not reformed enough. They don't want the interference of the government in the church. And when you look at the 16th century in England, the government in the form of the kings and queens are certainly very involved in the church. They're laying the direction for the church. They're controlling many of the, well, ultimately the doctrines of the church. They're at least giving it their seal of approval, and they're certainly appointing the people who are drawing up prayer books and things like that. So, and when you look at the Tudor kings and queens, their their involvement, their concern is naturally politics. They're concerned about the peace of their kingdom. And so they tend to come down on the side of moderation within the church. They don't want trouble. And so they support moderate church people within the church. There's one queen, Queen Mary, who's actually a Roman Catholic. So she, you know, Henry dies. His son Edward is king for a while. He supports moderate policies. Henry had, you know, other than wanting a divorce, Henry never really was into the whole Protestant thing to begin with. He really would have been pretty happy being a Catholic. But his son Edward follows a moderate policy. Mary, Bloody Mary, she came to be known, follows Edward. She's a Roman Catholic, and she wants to drag the church back into Catholicism. She wants to drag England back into Catholicism. And there's a time of great persecution. This is a time when Protestants are burned at the stake. 280 Protestants are burned. Do you know any of the stories of the Protestant martyrs of that time? Those are the ones I was going to mention. Yeah. John Fox, in his Book of Martyrs, tells some very inspiring stories. Thomas Cranmer was a man who had recanted. He'd written a recantation of Protestantism in an effort to save his life, and it didn't work. He was burned anyway. But as he was burned, he felt very bitter about that recantation. He regretted what he had done. But as he was being burned, as he's sitting there waiting for the fire to get closer, he holds his hand out, his right hand, into the flames, telling the crowd that his unworthy right hand that had signed the recantation is going to burn first. And Hugh Latimer and Nicholas Ridley. Latimer says to Ridley something like, "Be of good cheer, Mr. Ridley. Today, by God's grace, we shall light a candle in England which shall never be put out." That's what he said to Ridley as they were about to meet the flames. And Latimer was right. The effect of the martyrdoms of Protestants was profound. It helped to advance the Protestant cause. And there was a great backlash against Mary and her efforts. But there was also a great deal of people leaving England and Scotland, being exiled at this time. John Knox from Scotland goes to Geneva during this time, encounters Calvinism, goes back to Scotland, and Scotland becomes thoroughly reformed along Calvinist lines and becomes a Presbyterian nation. Well, the Tudors are gone with the 1500s, and in 1603, James VI of Scotland becomes James I of England. So now the Stuart dynasty is on the throne, and the Stuarts, interestingly, are Scottish. And it will be the Scottish Stuarts who are in power through most of the 17th century and during the time of our story. So James I is the, I guess you could say, where the trouble begins. When you start to think about the English Civil War, it's a struggle between the Parliament and the King. James I was the king for whom the doctrine, I mean, it's not like this doctrine didn't exist before, but the doctrine of the divine right of kings was championed. And James I rules as if he doesn't need a Parliament. Now, for centuries before this, the whole reason that kings would turn to Parliament was for money, right? You call a Parliament when you need your kingdom to give you money, usually so you can go to war. And the king is very much Although in England, it's not like the continent. The kings are not absolute rulers the way they are on the continent, but they're, you know, this is certainly the age of monarchy, right? The parliaments are not in a position to challenge the king, really, a whole lot, before the 17th century. And in the 17th century, that changes. Parliament rises up and challenges the authority of the king. So there's that political struggle. There's also a religious struggle that occurs side by side. So within the Church of England, you have Anglicans, Church of England members, who tend to support the king. You have Presbyterians and Puritan independents who tend to support Parliament. I say Puritan independents. They were, or just independents. You would call them independents at this time. Do you know who those people are? Cromwell, right. Denominationally, who are those people? Congregationalists, right. So, you know, I want to be a little cautious about using the word Puritan, because you can be an Anglican Puritan, and, you know, Puritanism is pretty vast, and over the centuries it takes a lot of forms. But at this time, when you talk about the independents, you're talking about people who support independent congregations. They want congregations to be sovereign. Each independent congregation is its own authority, and there should be no hierarchy over and above the congregation. So you have these nonconformists, these dissenters, these independents who tend to be more rigorously reformed, you could say, and they tend to side with Presbyterians against Anglicans. So in the 1630s, things start to come to a head. Charles I is the son of James I, and he rules very much as his father had tried to rule, as an absolute monarch. He has an Archbishop of Canterbury named Laud, who begins to persecute a lot of people outside the Anglican tradition. And, of course, that would include, you know, certain people within the Anglican tradition. They're not in the program. So, 16. But they might be cutting ears off, things like that. Certainly things that are happening that are very unpleasant and make some people go to Holland. Keep in mind, too, this is the age when people started to think about it. The pilgrims money come. Thereafter, many similar reasons. So Puritans flee to Holland to escape the persecution. And then things really start to come to a head in 1637. At this time, Charles introduces a prayer book into Scotland. And it's, you know, the English have their own prayer book. Charles is trying to unite the worship of the different kingdoms, England, Scotland, and Ireland. And he introduces a prayer book along those lines. And the Scots don't like it. What they object to is the book has pictures of angels in it, which is idolatry. You can't have that. There are instructions for a part of the worship service. I'm not sure if it's around communion, but there's a certain point in the service where the priest, the Anglican priest, is to stand facing east, away from the congregation. That's not cool, because there's a division between one of the aspects of the Reformation is that the clergy are not to be so separate from the laity. And so as you think about the way people worship. The reformers, you know, have the idea of the priesthood of all believers. They tend to try to diminish the separation of the clergy from the laity. Of course, they want the Bible in people's own languages. They want the worship service in people's own languages. And they take great offense at the idea that at this point in the service that the clergyman is turning away from the congregation. So some of these things I think we would probably find very trivial, but the Scots of 1637 do not. Their response is riots, and in 1638 the National Covenant in defense of Presbyterianism. They're very concerned also in terms of politics. They don't want to see bishops imposed on the church in Scotland. But in the book, when you hear characters talking about the earlier covenant or the first covenant, that's the covenant that they're talking about. Mr. Edgar?
Was there some of the signers of that national covenant, did they sign it in blood?
Good question. I don't know.
Wouldn't
surprise me, but I don't know. And Charles attempts to deal with this. He sends forces up to Scotland, and they don't do very well. The leaders of the Covenanter army, so the Covenanters are the people who signed this covenant, and they're led by David Leslie and
Montrose. Montrose is one of the characters in the book.
Reference to the bishops war as well. So now, now we're really getting into the time of the book. So, as I said, Charles' forces don't do very well going up to Scotland, and what Charles has to do, like many kings before him, is he has to go to Parliament and get money so that he can really take the war to Scotland the way he wants to. He calls Parliament together for money, and Parliament is not in any hurry to give him money. They're very upset by the fact that they haven't met for something like 11 years, and they got a lot of history that they want to go over with Charles before they start talking about money. So they call this the short Parliament because it lasts for 3 weeks. The king dissolves the Parliament because he's not interested in hearing their complaints. Then Scots invade northern England, and they seize territory in northern England, and the deal that they make with the king is, we'll leave when we receive X number of pounds ratified by the Parliament. Meaning, until the Parliament agrees to this, we're not leaving. So there's another Parliament. This is called the Long Parliament, interestingly, right? Because when you have Scots controlling many of your northern counties, and you can't get rid of them until Parliament votes the money to do it, that Parliament might be around a while, and this one was. It was around for several years, for the duration of the Civil War. In 1641, there is a massacre in Ulster, Ireland. 3,000 Protestants are massacred. It's the biggest massacre of civilians in the history of the British Isles. And Parliament is naturally very upset, wants to do something about it, and has a problem. Because if they vote money for the king to suppress the rebellion in Ireland, they're afraid that the king could use the army to suppress Parliament. So they have a dilemma. And this really is kind of a tipping point, because up to this time, within Parliament, a lot of the forces in Parliament have really just been concerned about parliamentary rights. They haven't been trying to overthrow the king. There's none of that's happening. They've just been concerned about things like they want Parliament to be somewhat independent of the king. They want Parliament to meet every so often, every 3 years, every 2 years, with or without the king's permission. So they want to be able to be a permanent body, and they don't want to be dependent on the king for calling their meetings. That's an example of one of the things they care about. But at this point, when Parliament is faced with this dilemma of raising an army to deal with the Irish and being afraid that the king will use that army against them, that forces them to decide who's going to control the army. Well, whichever group or person controls the army is going to be supreme. So Parliament has to face the question, are we superior to the king, or is the king superior to us? And that's where they reach the point, many people are saying, we're superior to the king. In the following year, 1642, they pass a militia bill giving Parliament control over the militia. They want to raise militia. They appoint commanders of the militia in various counties. And Charles' response is to unfurl his flag, and the war begins. And for the first year or two, royalist forces do pretty well. It's not dramatic, but there are two things that happen that help the parliamentary forces. One is, in 1643, there is a solemn league and covenant signed between Englishmen and Scotsmen, and this allows for the entry of Scottish troops to help the parliamentary forces for a large payment of money. It also commits Parliament to establishing the Presbyterian Church in England. So in our book, when the characters are talking about the covenant, this is the covenant that they're really talking about. Our story begins in 1644. And so they'll make reference to the earlier covenant, but the main covenant that is the bone of contention in the story is this covenant. The Scottish entry into the war helps. Another thing that really helps is the emergence of Oliver Cromwell's Ironsides. Cromwell is a leader of parliamentary forces. He's, I guess you'd say, a military genius. And his troops are religiously very fervent. Some, their enemies would call them fanatics, but their religious fervor certainly helps them as soldiers. They're tough to beat. They're committed troops. They know what they believe in, and they're fighting for a cause. So, the new model army is the reorganized parliamentary army along Cromwellian lines. They defeat Charles' forces in 1645. The Covenanters defeat the Scottish Highlander Montrose in 1645 as well. Highlanders, by the way, a lot of them are Catholics. A lot of them come down and support the king. Montrose is not a Catholic. You'll see that in our story. But he's fighting for the king. And he's defeated by the Covenanters. Charles surrenders to the Scots. Charles begins to try to play the Presbyterians and the Independents off against each other. So he's first captured by the Scots, and the Scots try to negotiate. They have a list of demands. Charles delays. Charles makes counter-demands. Scots get fed up with negotiating with him and hand him over to Parliament, and the game continues. But now what's happening is you're starting to see division between a Presbyterian-dominated Parliament and an army which is more independent, more Puritan independent oriented. And there's a group called the Levellers who are influential. The Levellers have new doctrines, and I want to read a description of the Levellers. These Levellers, of whom there were probably 10,000 in London, were mostly independents in religion. Because they were independents, they opposed the national church with appointed officials and ecclesiastical hierarchies, They would ordain their own clergy in congregations relatively independent and self-sufficient. They would conduct their own form of worship without authority from ecclesiastical powers or civil magistrates. A democratic set of ideas such as these, arising from religious causes, easily became political in their direction and consequences. Thus, many independents, within and without the army, wishing no classic hierarchy to ride our consciences that Christ set free, also found themselves politically democratic levelers. The levelers were not only common soldiers, they were artisans, small tradesmen, and farmers interested in maintaining human rights, the rights of Englishmen as persons. Behind legal rights of property and station, they saw natural rights and natural justice. Political equality, they declared, should have no economic implications. Parliament should represent the people, not property. Sovereignty lies only in the people, and Parliament governs only by their consent. Thus came into prominence the leveler ideas of inalienable rights of the individual, of law having authority by the consent of the people, of the origin of government in an original compact, and finally the opinion that the powers of the government should be limited by a fundamental law emanating from the people. The laws of the land are only valid when they are a statement of higher laws. So, some of the language is a little unfortunate. Human rights is a 20th century term with a lot of baggage. Really shouldn't be applied to people in the 16th or 17th century at all. The very name levelers, you know, sounds like communist, right? And it talks about democratic ideals. It's a little bit of 20th century terminology and biases slipping into the text, but I think we get the gist of what the levelers were about. They were about Republican ideals. And we see a lot of those ideas, and we recognize those as being very significant later on. So the levelers put forth a list of demands. Cromwell, and they actually want a national vote on their quote-unquote constitution. But Cromwell delays, gets them to submit it to Parliament. Parliament isn't going to do anything along those lines. And I point it out because it's important to recognize the role that these religious ideas, as the text did point out, a lot of the political ideas which became very foundational in the development of American government, and which were very foundational in the advance of republicanism within England, those political ideals originated in the church, and they grew out of people's ideas about church government. Anyway, in 1647, Charles agrees to establish Presbyterianism in England, and the Scots invade England to help him, but they're defeated. Independents under Cromwell take control of Parliament. Charles is executed. Cromwell goes up to Scotland after Charles II, Charles I's son, is crowned there, and David Leslie is defeated by Cromwell. So, again, just to wrap it all up, the English Civil War is very significant. It's really profoundly significant. It's profoundly significant for Americans, because what happens in America throughout the colonial era is sort of a replay of the English Civil War. American colonies, the colonial legislative bodies, encounter royal governors, and they sort of reenact on a mini scale all through the colonial era this struggle between legislatures and executive powers. And then the American Revolution mirrors it. So it's an important thing to think about. And it's important, especially, again, when we get to the subject of separation of church and state. Nowadays, we have an impression of that term, which is very 21st century-ish. And we think a lot about militant atheists and secularists who say that Christians shouldn't have any role in the public realm. And that's what the term is used for. But it's important to remember and understand that the idea of the separation of church and state is an idea that originated here among Puritan independents, people who didn't want an established church. And when the Puritans came to New England, colonial New England was about as theocratic a state as you could get, but it was a state where Puritan leaders were very concerned to make sure that there was separation of church and state. You were going to have church authorities, and you were going to have civil authorities, and they're both under God, and it was very important to New England Puritans to make sure that church authorities not usurp state powers and state authorities not usurp church powers. That was the New England 17th century Puritan idea of separation of church and state. So, something to think about as we go through the book. And just on a final note, an almost final note, interesting to think about the Salem witch trials in 1692. I won't say anything more about that right now, because we've got to move on. But interesting to think about, especially when you think about the modern world and the view of Puritans. Here's John Buchan, member of Parliament, writer, author of The 39 Steps, was his most famous book. Alfred Hitchcock made a movie about it. And our book, Witchwood. I guess I'll end with this quote from his autobiography. After that, I varied my tales of adventure with this kind of romance, over which I took a great deal of pains, and which seems to me the most successful of my attempts at imaginative creation. Being equally sensitive to the spells of time and of space, to attractive years and attractive landscape, I tried to discover the historical moment which best interpreted the ethos of a particular countryside, and to devise the appropriate legend. Just as certain old houses, like the inns at Burford and Queensferry, cried out to Robert Louis Stevenson to tell their tales, so I felt the clamor of certain scenes for an interpreter. The best, I think, is Witchwood, of which I wrote of the Tweedside parish of my youth, at the time when the old wood of Caledon had not wholly disappeared, and when the rigors of the new Calvinism were contending with the ancient secret rites of Diana. I believe that my picture is historically true, and I could have documented almost every sentence from my researches on Montrose. He'd written a biography on Montrose, as well as another one on Cromwell. But the plan is to read three chapters each week, so we'll read the first three chapters for next week. I made a list of Scottish words. My
text is very difficult in that there's a lot of Scottish
I thought, oh, this is a little bit more modern, but I'm not sure that that's really the case, so I don't know. But I hope that helps you.
It has those. Yeah.
It has those words? Okay. Well, I hope that's helpful. Well, would anyone like to close us in prayer? Please.
Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for this opportunity to get into this new literature book. We ask that you prepare for our worship service coming up, that you would help us to have a heart and life.